Once Socrates got familiar with his two advisory daemones, he was able to turn outwards toward others and be comfortable in social contact. Well, relatively comfortable. He acquired close and loyal friends, such as Crito, Meno, Chaerephon, Euripides, Aristophanes, and half a dozen others. Indeed, he was rich in friendship. But he could only get along with people in general by irritating them. His rule of social intercourse was, whoever allows himself to be offended deserves to be. Socrates found that he could best engage people in conversation by antagonism. Otherwise, he would either lose his train of thought or lose interest in what the other person was saying. He also found that if he concealed what he intended to say, not wholly but partially, the conversation got a lot more interesting on both sides. His tactic was so new and distinctive that Socrates became widely and uniquely known for using it. Notorious, in fact. The sophists, ever jealous of anyone introducing a new technique of rhetoric, called this neat little trick of his ironia. His sophistical opponents were extremely irritated at the casual way Socrates baited and antagonized people, and they compared him to a nasty, niggling insect, a gadfly. The effect of ironia was so disarming that Socrates had the edge in every conversation. He gained quite a few enemies among the sophists, but other people flocked to him for a breath of fresh air, and, if they dared, to have their pretenses challenged. Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaian Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered here and there across the planet and through space and time, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is the navigator of the GNE, John Lash, recording on the 17th of January, 2014. This is nav briefing number 105, the Code of Non-Offense. To kick off this briefing, I chose to read an excerpt from one of Lydia's recapitulations. You may or may not be familiar with the Lydia material on metahistory.org. I began to post this material way back in May of 2008 with Lydia's vow. Well, there is a series of files developing on Lydia's part of the site, which is called Lydia's Well. And if you go and look into her department, you'll see that there is a category called the Ninefold Recapitulation. And these recapitulations of Lydia are numbered from 9 down to 1 in reverse order. Drop down to recapitulation number 6, and lo and behold, there is Socrates, Greece, 469 to 399 BCE. If you click on that recapitulation and scroll down to the gadfly, which is a subheading, you'll find the introductory paragraph that I just read. It occurred to me that that citation would be a fitting lead-in to the current briefing, especially the line attributed to Socrates, imputed to Socrates, whoever allows himself to be offended deserves to be. That was, for Socrates, a rule of social conduct. So I offer you that little proposition from ancient times concerning ancient manners to suck on like a sour lemon ball and just keep it in the corner of your cheek and roll it around so you can really get the taste of it. Let me add, before I get into the core material of this briefing, that I intend to include, if it doesn't slip away from me, a bit of commentary on the concept of the illusion of compassion. I do that in response to a message from a crew member inquiring if I might define exactly what I mean by that term. So I'll see if I get around to that toward the latter part of the briefing. For right now, at the 5-minute, 35-second mark, let me take a shot at defining cogently what may be understood by the term non-offense. And as it sometimes happens, because I am correcting myself as I go along and I'm learning as I teach, I'm going to instantly correct the term from non-offense to no offense. Because no offense is the beginning of a sentence that all Kalaka warriors can repeat when they enter the ranks of the party. There is a sentence that begins with no offense when you enter the party. What is that sentence? Quote, no offense is barred in this party. End quote. Therefore, we abide by or observe or honor the code of no offense. Note carefully my correction from non-offense, okay? Now, what does this mean? I mean, what are the implications of this statement? One thing it tells you is that in the Kalaka War Party, among ourselves, we observe a code of behavior. The code is both intra-rank, between those in the same rank, and inter-rank, between those in different ranks. But it is not extra-party. It does not apply to social behavior in the world at large. Now, Socrates famously and infamously applied his principle, whoever allows himself to be offended deserves to be, openly in society, specifically in the Athenian society of that time. I want to make it clear here in the 100 range of the briefings, as I introduce the code of the Kalaka War Party, to develop it with you in real time, that this code is only for us in the party. It is not a code to be practiced in social circles at large, unless you want to go out and just wreak havoc for the fun of it. Which I must admit, I myself have been inclined to do off and on during my life. And to be foolishly candid about it, more often than not. But nevertheless, there's a boundary situation here. The code of no offense is meant for the Kalaka War Party and not for ordinary social interactions. Clear enough? In regard to ordinary social interactions, in regard to social engagements, to operating in the world at large, in the tonal, Kalaka warriors have an agreement to direct their actions and intentions according to the framework of Gaian ethics. So Gaian ethics frames and directs our activities as a war party externally, and the code of no offense guides and directs our actions internally. Clear enough? Also, if you get all that, then get this as well. I am simply proposing that it can be like this within certain human relationships now and in the future. It can be this way. And if you would enjoy partaking of this type of behavior, of being in a relationship with one or more people where no offense is banned, no offense is treated as a cause for rejection, no offense is regarded as a pretext for righteousness, and no offense is allowed to lead members of the group to turn against each other, if you would enjoy that, then who knows? Maybe it can happen. Maybe it can manifest. I'm simply making a proposal. But the key to that proposal, to the success of this proposition, is enjoyment. If you would enjoy behaving in this way and being in the company of others who behave in the same manner, then you're on. You're on the way to copacetic. Because copacetic is where two individuals in the Gallic War Party would arrive after some offense arose between them. In the Gallic War Party, each member has the freedom to offend. But what goes along with that, and take note, is the freedom to be offended. You can be offended if you want to, but it's understood by all members of the Gallic War Party that anyone who shows themselves to be offended is revealing Zadok, or righteousness. Remember that I said in the previous briefing, taking offense is nothing more or less than an excuse to be righteous. Now, if you have no righteousness in you, you will not take offense. It is impossible to offend someone who has eliminated the Zadok principle from his or her psyche and sensibility. It is simply impossible. So the rule, the test, is easy. And everyone listening to me now can apply this test. I ask you, I request of you, apply this test to yourself. Can you still be offended by anything? Would you be offended by something that someone said or did to you? I mean, ask yourself honestly and come up with an instance of offense if you can. Well, whatever you come up with, it shows you that there is an abiding presence of Zadok, or the need to be righteous, operating in your mind and in your life, and that is a most unfortunate affair. You know, I talked a lot and wrote a lot about Zadok in the ancient Hebrew religious context. And I explained that Zadok is a principle that operates in human behavior due to a foreign installation, if I might use the happy phrase of Carlos Castaneda, a foreign installation engenders Zadok in the human mind and operates to the quality of envy and operates nefariously, insidiously, with the quality of envy in a self-concealing and deceptive manner. Now, we could spend the rest of our lives studying the behavior of the enemy, the Zads, the Zadokites, those who pursue the agenda of master race supremacy upon this planet. And of course, there's a big challenge in facing these adversaries of humanity. They are the self-declared adversaries of humanity, as I've often noted. But in undertaking the strategic and tactical considerations that have to be made in facing that enemy, don't forget to look for the principle that drives that enemy, as it may operate within your own mind and psyche. If you can be offended and have been offended by anything that anyone has said or done to you, you carry Zadok, and you are righteous, and in that respect, you are accessory to the worst that the righteous can do. And I think you know by now, if you've been listening to me, that the worst that the righteous can do is pretty fracking awesome. And would you want to be accessory to that in even the slightest manner? I don't think so. Not if you really have the heart of a genuine human animal. So don't be accessory to the righteous. And may the righteous be damned. And if you do not wish to damn yourself along with them, then you can examine and eliminate the Zadok in your own heart. But that could be a lonely and desolating exercise. And you might not be able to do a good job of it if you don't have a reality check. Well, no problem there, because those of us in the Calico War Party all agree that we can offend each other left, right, and center. Remember, come into the Calico War Party with a sentence that begins, quote, "No offense, dot, dot, dot." Well, make up variations of that sentence and say them out loud. For instance, here's a variation of that sentence. Quote, "No offense can be instructive enough." End quote. Another sentence. "No offense gets away without leading to copacetic." End quote. Now there's a statement. There's a statement. There's a variation, a permutation of the code of the Calico War Party. What is this code? Beats the fracking poop out of me. I have no idea what this code is. I'm inventing it as I'm telling you about it right now. And you invent it with me in your interactions with me on the occasion that we have the privilege to meet each other. But on the occasion that we don't, you invent it among yourselves, two at a time in a buddy system. No offense allowed that does not lead to copacetic, end quote. So offenses are allowed, but they are not allowed unless they lead to copacetic. What does that mean? It means that for the members of the Warrior Party, I'll put it in the first person because it illustrates it more directly. If I offend you, then I look to you and I rely on you to take offense. Go right ahead, but get over it. You get over taking offense, and I'll get over offending you, and then we're copacetic. We like to take offense. Another quote, quote, "No offense in the Calico Warrior Party is looked upon with disapproval," end quote. Why? Because any offense that one member of the party makes toward another is an occasion to get over it together and be copacetic. We must be copacetic. Copacetic is where human relationships reach on the other side of righteousness, judgment, and insane, non-evidential presumptions that one person makes upon another. It is inevitable that human animals are going to get on each other's toes, tread on each other's toes, or get under each other's skin. In fact, I've got an ongoing conversation happening now with Kundry, which we laugh and cackle like old witches hiding in caves outside Rhonda, because we're talking about how nasty the Anthropos is and what a nasty critter it is. You know, like a nasty weasel or raccoon. You know, raccoons are nasty, you know. The Anthropos is nasty. The Anthropos can be nasty. Oh, yes, indeedy, Aunt Jemima. Can the Anthropos be nasty? You don't think so? Go sit down and sit through under the sign of Scorpio by Yuri Lina. The Anthropos can be nasty. And the Anthropos can be nasty in a lot of other petty and minor ways and hypocritical, trivial ways too. And looking at the nastiness of the Anthropos is, or can be, if you care and dare to engage in that exercise, can be extremely salubrious. It can raise your mental health and your emotional health to a lovely pitch of sanity. The subject of the nastiness of the Anthropos is absolutely fascinating and belongs within the genre of Gaian ethics and the discussion of Gaian ethics. Were I to get into it a little further in this briefing, it would, however, lead to a digression. So I'm only going to comment on it briefly. What can I say? Well, two things. First of all, the nastiness of the Anthropos puts the Anthropos as an animal in the same framework with other animals on the planet. Because if you look at any other animals, such as birds, seabird colonies, you look at penguins, you look at, hey, you know, sea lions and walruses. You look at walruses. You want to see some nastiness. You got to look into the puss of a walrus on a beach, having a squabble with other walruses. And it's so grotesque that it's actually funny. And this nastiness that occurs throughout all animal species, it applies to ants, it applies to insects, to snakes, it applies to birds. This nastiness is the expression of what? What are you going to do? Are you going to ask yourself with alarm, oh dear, how could the Pleuromycaeons, who are nothing but luminous fountainheads of love and generosity, emanate creatures that are endowed with such a capacity to be nasty? Oh, my dear, I'm very upset that it's this way. We'll take a few steps back and consider a term which is found as the title of a book by Robert Ardrey, A-R-D-R-E-Y. Now, Robert Ardrey was a brilliant ethologist of the middle of the 20th century. And his books contain, in extremely eloquent English prose, he was a beautiful writer, some of the best descriptions of animal behavior that you will ever find. And Robert Ardrey, who spent decades of his life in Africa, wrote a book called The Territorial Imperative. The territorial imperative is what makes the Anthropos get nasty. And it's what makes all animals get nasty. And when you recognize the territorial imperative, you must admit, as a human animal, that we are on the same par as other animals. The simple and obvious fact is that all animals, including the human animal, get nasty, or can get nasty, when there is an infringement of boundaries. It's all about living space and the space around the particular animal or entity or creature, whether it be the space around a spider, and the space around a rattlesnake, and the space around a human being. Now, rattlesnakes are not necessarily nasty, but they can get pretty nasty if you get in their space. I can get a bit nasty if you get in my space. One of the first things that I experienced in coming to Europe was the fact that Europeans have a completely different sense of personal space than Americans. So if you're waiting at line in the post office in America, people will stand a certain distance behind you. If you're waiting in line in a post office in France or Belgium or Germany or Holland, they'll stand practically on top of you, breathing down your neck, and they don't even mind if they're slightly touching you. It's nothing to them because they have a different sense of personal space. They don't get nasty being crowded that way, but I do. So I would ask someone to move back, politely at first. If they didn't move back or stayed in my space, I would get nasty. So the basis of nastiness in the anthropos is simply due to the fact that we share the same situation with all other animals on the planet, that all things that live need their space to live. But it becomes more complicated with a human animal, because being highly subjective and having a highly self-reflective intelligence, we also have mental space as well as physical space. So people get nasty when you intrude on their mental space. Translate that this way. They get nasty when you offend their image of themselves, or when you offend some other idea or conception or pretense or presumption by which they maintain the space of their personal reality as a psychic space. And so you can look at another human animal and you can violate their psychic space and offend them simply by the way you're looking at them. And so the anthropos will get nasty about things that are subjective. Okay, let's bring in the ego. The anthropos will get nasty when the ego is offended and when the sense of the ego's world is threatened. Other animals don't have egos. And it's perfectly okay for the anthropos to be nasty. In fact, if you think about it and contemplate it with some detachment and dispassion, as an ethologist, it can become quite amusing. As I said, Kundry and I really have some wicked laughs discussing the nastiness of the anthropos. However, there is an evil factor that can come into play in such a way that the natural nastiness of the human animal is taken to horrific extremes. And what causes that to happen is the combination of nastiness and righteousness. When the faculty for nastiness, if you want to call it that, the instinct, which is a boundary instinct, is excited by righteousness, it becomes exaggerated and it becomes a nastiness that is beyond the scope of its actual evolutionary purpose, if you will. And this is what happens on the large scale that brings about epidemics of violence, brutality, murder, and genocide in the behavior of the human species. When you go back and you look at the Russian Revolution, I don't think there's anything comparable to it except the Maoist Revolution, which was a mimicry based on the same Marxist principles, based on the same Marxist lie the lie of communism, which is a hideous lie and a hideous system of indoctrination and domination concocted by bankers, if I may say so. In any case, looking just for a moment at the Russian Revolution, I mean, it really does surpass the human capacity to comprehend how anything could have gone as far as that, you know, if you've looked into it, even slightly. I think you'd agree with what I'm saying. Well, the Russian Revolution was not the work of Russians. Allow me to insert a brief footnote, a brief historical footnote here. There were two starts to the Russian Revolution. The first occurred in January of 1905 and produced a mass popular uprising known as the February Revolution. The second one occurred 12 years later in 1917, and that was known as the October Revolution. If you look at these two different revolutions, you see that they are utterly different in character. The February Revolution of 1905 began with a specific incident that was spontaneous and unplanned, the incident of Bloody Sunday, which occurred on January 22, 1905. Some people, led by a priest, a Russian Orthodox priest, I believe, had gone to the Winter Palace with a petition of protest. But violence broke out against the petitioners, and the crowd who had assembled for the presentation of the petition came under attack by armed guards with sabers, and they were hacked to pieces. And this is called the famous Bloody Sunday incident. You can see a scene of it in Dr. Zhivago, David Lean's film. However, in the manner that it's scripted in the Dr. Zhivago film, you see Yuri Zhivago, played by Omar Sharif, looking out the window of his house at the Bloody Sunday massacre. And David Lean never turns the camera to what Zhivago is seeing. But you see on the face of Omar Sharif the reflection of the horror that he beholds. Now, this Bloody Sunday event was a spontaneous event. It was not planned or orchestrated. It was a nodal moment, an incendiary moment, in the general popular uprising of the Russian people. And to the extent that you look in general terms at the 1905 revolution, you can say it was really a revolution of the Russian people and of the lower classes and of all those in Russia, including many in the aristocratic classes as well, and many of the intellectuals and artists who wanted to see a complete overthrow of the tyranny of Tsarist society and wanted to have a new Russia and a different Russia. It was a true revolutionary moment inspired by genuine impulses emerging from the hearts and minds of people. Similar to what I experienced living in the 1960s in the youth movement and in the psychedelic revolution of that moment. A genuine and spontaneous upsurge of the human desire for freedom and for a better and fairer world. Okay. Compare that event to the October Revolution of 1917. Well, what is the signal moment in the October Revolution? You might recall from Yuri Lina's film that the Bolsheviks entered the Winter Palace at exactly 2:10 a.m. on November 8, 1917. How's that for planning? How's that for timing? the well-known evidence of the historical circumstances of these two revolutions show that the second revolution was entirely different in character. They walked into the Winter Palace at a pre-designated moment, down to the minute. Who organized that? Who determined astrologically that that would be the moment that the Bolsheviks would take control of the Winter Palace? If you want to do some homework that would be relevant to some of my future briefings and post-reset briefings, then go and look at the entry Judeo-Bolshevism in Wikipedia. Bear in mind, of course, that Wikipedia is highly edited by trolls who are working for the Hasbara objective, that is to say, for the control of the narrative. Nevertheless, some truth and some genuine historical evidence does come through the sieve from time to time. But if you go and read this article on Judeo-Bolshevism, and I have some comments on that further down the road, if it doesn't entirely slip my mind. And if you investigate the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, then you will conclude, as any sane person does, that the Bolshevik Revolution was a totally and meticulously orchestrated and manipulated event directed by a party of Jewish ideologues who were intent upon forcing communism upon Russia. And the communism that they wished to force upon Russia was the brainchild of bankers like the Warburgs and the Schiffs, who generously funded these Jewish ideologues. A whole boatful of them left the United States, about 200 Jewish Bolsheviks, Jewish revolutionaries, left the United States after being primed and prepped in New York City by Jewish bankers in order to go and implement the second Russian Revolution in Russia. And that revolution was directed at the genocidal elimination of the Russian people themselves. So if you don't know anything else about history, you need to know that in the Kalika War Party, we do conduct some history lessons and investigations. And we look very closely at the Russian Revolution to see how its equivalent and parallel on a global scale might be prevented right now. And the point I'm making here, which comes back to the point of righteousness, is that Judeo-Bolshevism is driven by the principle of Tzaddik as much as the Talmud, as much as the Torah, and as much as anything that you can ascribe to the ancient Jewish sect of the Tzaddikite, you can ascribe to the atheist Zionist Bolshevik movement, because it is the same phenomenon. And so the Russian Revolution demonstrates where human animals can be driven when the principle of Tzaddik righteousness combines with human nastiness. Okay, such are some considerations that I would offer on the topic of Tzaddik. And having said that, let's come back to the Kalika War Party and the Code of No Offense. Considering the understanding of how dangerous Tzaddik is, how it is really the seed of human insanity, the seed of deviance and depravity that causes war and injustice on this planet, considering all that, you can be damn sure that we don't want no Zedek in the Calico War Party. Nevertheless, it's quite possible and probable that those who come into the party will have some element of righteousness operating in their psyches. And it would be wrong to exclude anyone for that reason. That would be ridiculous. Who's going to be the gatekeepers? Who's going to stand there and vet people and say, sorry, you can't join the Calico War Party because we have, our Zedek detector has, gone off the charts with you. Oh, we even have a small reading, but a small reading is too much. We need to have zero Zedek for membership in the Calico War Party. Well, this is all completely ridiculous. There's nothing of the sort. What is required and what is really an elegant and humane solution is to allow a fence within the party on the agreement that the members offending and offended will stick it out together, get over it together, and go to copacetic. Are you getting a feeling of the power and beauty and elegance and efficacy of this word, copacetic? Now, you're not going to get copacetic with people in society at large. Well, don't waste your time. You may occasionally want to choose a specimen of someone that you know who's not in the Calico War Party and practice some offending action on them. In fact, I just got a brilliant example of that today in an email from a crew member. Let me refer to it for a moment because it's really a kick. Now, I'm going to edit carefully in citing this letter because I didn't ask the permission of the person who sent it. But I will quote this paragraph verbatim. Quote, I have really been feeling the surge of energy from the earth the last week or so. It feels like a boundless, translucent, luscious, cool breeze. It gives me a feeling of protection and confidence in what is yet to come as far as what my own part of this story entails. With the fearlessness to express oneself comes the responsibility of being copacetic, indeed, three times over. End quote. This mirrors my own feelings so closely, especially in the way that he describes the surge coming from the earth. You may recall my description of the white liquid blaze of fire, the blaze of warrior courage that I have been feeling since the beginning of the shift. Anyway, the crew member goes on to say that a member of his family is a figure athlete. I've never heard this term before, but it's like a bodybuilder. And so he decided to challenge her in this way. She and her partner are apparently active in the bodybuilding movement and that sort of thing. And so they produce, they appear and they write and produce in these bodybuilding magazines, which show these people, as you know, in these various postures where they're showing off their muscles and showing off how tough they are. And so in this mail, the crew member is proposing, he says, I told her to write an article to bring the matter of pedophilia and the satanic nexus to the forefront to their readers, so that all these big, tough, and narcissistic people who are flashing their muscles can actually go out and crush those evil little maggots into oblivion with their powerful hands. What the hell else are they going to use them for, aside from posing in purple shiny sequined tongs for people? What a waste of crushing power and influence. So here you see what I would call Kalika strategy in action. Remember, the Kalikas are not all out to kill. Only the front ranks are involved in that sort of activity, the lethal strike and so forth. But many of the other ranks of the Kalika War Party are engaged in forms of social activism that address the problems of the world as correction proceeds. And these forms of social activism, these forms of engagement with the non-corrective factors in our society and in our world to overcome them in favor of correction, these forms of engagement are all to be spontaneously invented and developed as correction proceeds. And here's an example in this email of someone, a crew member, proposing or inventing a Kalika strategy. Can you imagine that these bodybuilding magazines would suddenly begin to feature a column or a section of the magazine each month dedicated to the news, the latest news about pedophile rings and the satanic nexus? Just imagine what a deterrent that would present in the world at large. Even if the people reading the magazines did not actually go out in some vigilante fashion and take down these pedophiles, wherever they might find them, in their lairs or on the street, when the knowledge got around to the pedophiles that they were being exposed to such people, it would put fear into them. It would be a deterrent. So here we see an example of a crew member, possibly someone who finds himself within the ranks of the Kalika War Party, going to someone he knows in his family and intentionally offending them with a proposal of this kind. So, as I said earlier, if you want to practice offense outside the Kalika War Party, you can do so. But it may stir people up in a good way, and it may produce a good result. But the code of non-offense is a given within the party. It's a code of behavior, a COB, that all party members share. I think I've made it eminently clear that along with that code comes the responsibility to stand in the process and to get over both taking offense and giving offense and reach copacetic. There's tremendous freedom in the warrior party, unlike that which you may be able to find in society at large. By an act of consent, the members of the party share this freedom. It is the freedom to express yourself without concern that offense will be taken and used against you. In the warrior party, offense is taken as an opportunity to get copacetic. It's as simple as that. The discipline of Kalika warriors consists in an act of releasement. Releasement from the illusion of control. Releasement from the desire to control the way that you affect others, or to control what they think of you. Impression management, to use the banal term. Kalikas would not manage their impressions they make upon each other. Rather, they would handle the raw energy in the transactions that occur in the impressions that they do make, there's a risk to be taken in reaching another human animal. And out in the world at large, there is no guarantee that that risk will not lead to estrangement and alienation and separation and division. But in the Calico War Party, there is a security that reaching another human being, even with negative emotions, is acceptable and leads to copacetic. At the 50-minute mark of this briefing, it would perhaps be the moment to turn to the second subject, closely related to the Kalika Code of No Offense, and that is the subject of the illusion of compassion. I have an email dated the 17th from crew member Laurel, in which she writes, among other things, "I have no recollection of ever hearing you define what exactly that experience consisted of." She's referring to my experience of being alleviated of the illusion of compassion back in 2008. She goes on, "How are you defining the word compassion in this example? How have you come to the conclusion that the experience that you are labeling with the word compassion is an illusion? How exactly was this illusion dispelled, and how would you describe what, if anything, has taken place of the experience of compassion in your life, has taken the place of the experience of compassion in your life?" She continues, "My past experiences with your MetaHistory.org search engine have not been particularly encouraging, and when I enter the illusion of compassion and MetaHistory in a regular search engine, I only get articles in which you say the same thing, again without any supporting detail, that Kali breaks all illusions, including the illusion of compassion. The way you say it seems to indicate that this is an important quote to you, and presumably you wouldn't repeat it unless you wanted it to be important to others also. It would certainly be helpful to my own understanding, and I suspect to others also, if you could elaborate on this quote in enough detail to make it clear what exactly you mean by it," end quote. And she says, "Thank you." Well, I say, "Thank you, Laurel," and here goes. While I'm not going to recount the experiences of that time in 2008 when I was in the turbulence of receiving the Terma of Gaia awakening, and I'm not going to go into the personal circumstances and details because it would take too long, I can specify, I think pretty cogently, the realizations that I drew at that moment. The first thing that I came to understand as the illusion of compassion is the presumption that if you perform an act of kindness purely for the sake of being kind, that act will not necessarily produce the desired result. In other words, the notion of compassion assumes that human animals are able to act toward other human animals with a feeling of common suffering, which is what compassion means, to suffer with. And so, the act of compassion presumes that you can act in a way that addresses or touches the suffering of another person. But as a matter of fact, in reality, there are many occasions when people don't want their suffering to be touched, and they don't really want you to meddle with their suffering. And so a genuine act of compassion, as I found out on a number of occasions, or what I thought was a genuine act of compassion, backfired and did not produce the result of being beneficial or consoling to the person to whom it was directed. And from those circumstances, I concluded that it was an illusion to think that an act of reaching another person purely on the motive of kindness and compassion would benefit that person. That's the illusion of compassion. In the manner in which compassion is normally considered, it is thought to be some kind of almost miraculous force. We wish for compassion to be a miraculous force. We wish for it to have, when we act compassionately, we wish for that action to convey a healing and succoring effect, a comforting effect, merely by the fact that we know it to be compassionate and we intend it compassionately. But what I observed in my own experience was that the actual effect was not consistent with that intention of kindness. The person receiving the compassionate act or word did not respond to it in a way that was beneficial to themselves. Now, that could have been because I was unskillful in my expression of compassion. And I thought about that very deeply. And what I concluded was, perhaps it could have been unskillfulness on my part. But I definitely detected a resistance to compassion in the individual to whom it was directed. So there is another point in the illusion of compassion. One exercises compassion on the presumption that it's not going to be resisted. Because why would anyone resist anything as wonderful as compassion? But as a matter of fact, I find that a large percentage of what I have considered to be acts of compassion have not produced the desired effect in the person to whom they were directed. Therefore, I assumed that I was operating under an illusion of compassion. If your experience proves that people do not receive acts of kindness kindly, well, then you might draw the conclusion that compassion is counterproductive in some way. That compassion may carry an illusion concerning the benefit to the party to whom it's directed. Now, I call presumption of benefit the primary illusion of compassion. And with the realization that compassion did not always produce the benefit to the other person that was intended, I had another realization, which was that perhaps compassion could be exercised in a way that was not wasted on people who would not benefit from the action. Now, bear in mind that when I talk about acts of compassion here, I'm talking primarily about interactions with other human beings, speaking with them, engaging with them in language, and delving into the intricacies of human behavior together, looking at things, talking about things together, and offering insight in the form of compassion. I'm not talking about working in a soup kitchen. I'm not talking about, obviously, you know, handing out clothes to poor people, which I've done. You know, I'm not talking about that kind of act of compassion. I'm not talking about bald and simple acts of charity here. I'm talking about something that's a little deeper and a little more complex. And so when I realized that my attempt to offer compassion to people based on my perception of their suffering was not taken well, I began to question whether people really wanted to get out of their suffering or not. Maybe they just didn't want to get out of it with me, and I can dig that. Maybe they just didn't want to overcome their suffering and be healed from their suffering with me as a witness and with me as an accomplice. Well, that's fine. That's their choice. Or maybe they didn't want to be healed at all because they had an investment in their suffering and their misery. And when you address compassion to people of that sort, it's wasted. And it is an illusion to think that it will work on people who are invested in their misery and suffering. After all, isn't the primary motive of compassion to alleviate the suffering of others? Again, I'm not talking about material suffering. I see somebody with no shoes and I buy them a pair of shoes. That's not an act of compassion. That's an act of charity. And I have to say I've exceeded myself in acts of charity over the last few years. And they do not even produce the desired result in the person to whom they're directed. I would say that Mother Teresa, globally recognized as a living instrument, an icon of compassion, practiced charity. Taking care of unwanted children is an act of charity. It's not necessarily an act of compassion. But let's leave that distinction aside for a moment. I'll see if I can focus on a couple of more points in the illusion of compassion, a couple of more of the insights that I had. I reflected a lot during the year 2008 on what is called the Bodhisattva vow. Have you ever heard about the Bodhisattva vow? It's something you encounter in Buddhism. It's a concept in Buddhism. And I've been surprised through my life that so few Buddhists actually know what it is. The Bodhisattva vow can be stated like this. A Bodhisattva is a human animal who seeks enlightenment, be it a man or a woman. And let's say that that Bodhisattva can actually attain enlightenment. They can do so because they have the inner disposition to be enlightened, which is bodhi, and they carry that disposition in a harmonious and balanced way, in a sattvic manner. And so they are able to attain enlightenment. So let's say that enlightenment can be attained. Let's just pretend that that's the case for a moment. According to the conventional definition, then, the conventional and mundane definition of enlightenment, the bodhisattva who attains it would pass into another condition entirely and would be, by that attainment, entirely removed from the human condition. They would achieve nirvana, which literally means a kind of extinction or blowing out. And so the Bodhisattva would attain a state of blissful emptiness and detachment and inactivity, in fact. These are qualities or attributes of the traditional definition of nirvana. Well, according to the Bodhisattva vow, the Bodhisattva who is on the threshold of attaining nirvana renounces it. It's a vow of renunciation. And the Bodhisattva says, I will forego the attainment of full enlightenment, full and unexcelled enlightenment, as it is sometimes called, Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. In order to remain engaged with sentient beings so that I can guide them to the experience of enlightenment, which I could attain and enter were I to choose to do so, but I forego doing so. And that renunciation and that commitment to guide sentient beings to enlightenment is the essence of the Bodhisattva vow. Now, I'm pretty sure I've paraphrased it correctly here. If I haven't, then someone who knows better may correct me. It's been quite a number of years now. First of all, I want to say that I was tremendously impressed at the age of 18 or 19 when I discovered the Bodhisattva vow. And I thought for sure that that was my calling, and I was going to take the Bodhisattva vow, and I considered myself to be a Bodhisattva in the making. But it's been some years now, I can't say how long, it's been a considerable stretch of time since I began deconstructing the Bodhisattva vow. And I can tell you honestly and bluntly today that I consider it to be a load of crap and nothing but a glorified con of self-importance. I'm not going to deconstruct or debunk the Bodhisattva vow right now because I don't have time in the remaining 6 minutes of this briefing. But I will point out the feature of my deconstruction of the Bodhisattva vow that applies to detecting the illusion of compassion. The Bodhisattva makes a commitment to lead all sentient beings to enlightenment, that is to say, to the liberation that comes with the realization of the nature of your own mind, and the realization that your ordinary mind, the mind that hears my words right now, is no different from the Buddha mind. Nor is it exactly the same as the Buddha mind, but it is both different and not different. And that realization, which is known to the enlightened mind, focuses the Bodhisattva on a goal to bring others to that realization, to free them into that fantastic emancipation of mind. There's just one hitch. Did it ever occur to the Bodhisattva to ask them first if they want to be free? Now, certainly, you're not exercising compassion if you're helping people do something that they don't want to do. They're not going to take it well. It's not going to work. I don't see any way the Bodhisattva vow can work on a number of counts. But primarily in this context here, again, it involves the illusion of compassion. And that illusion is yet another presumption. It is the presumption that people want to be free. And therefore, if you act in the compassion of a Bodhisattva to guide them to freedom, you will have success. But what if people don't want to be free? You know, not long after I discovered the Bodhisattva vow in my late teens, I'd say around the age of 24, 25, I read The Murder of Christ by Wilhelm Reich. And I got another blow, another huge impact delivered to my psyche when Wilhelm Reich raised the question, well, if the human animal is sitting there in the cage of character armoring, in the cage of its conditioning, of its social conditioning that turns it against its natural instincts and drives and desires. If it's just sitting there in this cage and the door of the cage is open, then why doesn't it walk out? And when I put that observation by Wilhelm Reich next to the Bodhisattva vow, I have to tell you I was facing a considerable dilemma. The way that I would put it today is that people can't handle freedom, even when they get it, even when they get a taste of it. And so if the intention of a compassionate act is releasement from suffering into freedom, I wish you luck. Now, allow me to qualify the word freedom here. I understand that people in the world today, probably a great, great mass of human animals, would like to be free of the predators and the psychopaths. They would like to be free of the oppression of the authorities. They would like to be free just to live and let live and go about their business without interference. And I am totally in the battle for that freedom. But the Bodhisattva vow is not premised on that kind of freedom. The Bodhisattva vow is premised on delivering transcendental freedom to human animals. And I can attest to you, as I live and breathe today, that I rarely run across a human animal who wants that kind of freedom. So I consider the Bodhisattva vow to be a con, you know, it's a grandiose scam. And it's a con of self-importance that assumes an objective that cannot be achieved because the subjects of the Bodhisattva's intention are unwilling to assume that intention for themselves. And they are unwilling and unable to operate at that level of freedom. Freedom is terrifying at the level of enlightenment when you know that the human condition is nothing but a fabric of illusions and imputations. When you know, for instance, as one Dzogchen master aptly put it, reality is only something that is imputed. Here is my cat sleeping on the bed. And the reality of my cat sleeping on the bed is imputed to the cat. What's left if I do not impute reality to the cat? What's left is what is really real. What is real without imputation. Now, this kind of discourse goes to a level of freedom that is, sorry to say, you know, beyond the reach of most human animals. And they don't even care to go there. If you showed them how to go there, they would turn away. And I have seen that happen. Some of us are old enough to recall a certain Tibetan master named Chogyam Trungpa. And one of the things that Trungpa warned about was what he called idiot compassion. So go look that up and read what Trungpa had to say about idiot compassion. And you'll find some additional insights, perhaps, on this topic of the illusion of compassion. So finally, I would add that I have come to the realization in my own life of what I do with compassion, insofar that I actually have the ability to be a compassionate person. I expend my compassion on warriors and only on warriors. I have no compassion for people who are not warriors. And so I have no scruples about being totally upfront. I admit that I can act in an inconsiderate and disrespecting way toward people who are not warriors on occasions when I might exhibit my compassion toward those non-warriors. I don't. And either I turn away with no expression, either I exhibit indifference, which is the opposite of love, or I can be flagrantly and vividly rude, inconsiderate, and disrespectful. And I can enjoy being so. Now, to bring the subject of compassion around to the subject of this briefing, how does compassion play into the code of no offense? That's a good question to conclude the briefing. Remember, I said that you come into the Calico War Party making statements that begin, quote, no offense, dot, dot, dot. So, how about this? No offense passes without compassion. Well, there you have it. Yet another spontaneous expression of the code of no offense in the Calico War Party. Give it a try.